This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Exit polls from the 2016 presidential election showed that 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. His call to make America great again somehow aligned with Christian nationals. It's this very notion that inspired Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove to write his new book, Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove lives in Durham. He's an author of a number of books and the director of the School for Conversion. And he comes back to our show today. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to see you.
Talk about this book and the genesis of this book, because it came from, I understand, a conversation that you had during an Easter dinner.
Yeah, I think a lot of people had these conversations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Easter of 2016, we're at the dinner table at my parents' house. My grandfather is there. Sort of the kind of archetype of the target of the Southern strategy for 50 years. You know, he was a Fox News watcher and all that. And also, you know, a loving person and a deeply committed Christian. And beside him, my 12-year-old son at the time, who's African-American. And he says, "Pa, are you really going to vote for Donald Trump?" And he said, "Well, you know, some people say things they don't really mean when they're running for office, this and that." And he's kind of him and hawing. And Jermichael said, but Pa, he's extreme." And there's just kind of this pause in the room, right? And I think, yeah, a lot of people have been grappling with that. So this book was an attempt to try to narrate, both for people within the faith and for those sort of watching from the outside, scratching their head, asking what's going on. Where, you know, how did it come to be that that people who are committed to, you know, this first century Palestinian Jew who talked about loving your neighbor and even your enemy, how are those folks, so many of them, especially those that are white, attracted to someone like Donald Trump?
Well, maybe nothing. Religion had nothing. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't strike me as a particularly religious fella.
No, he doesn't.
No. And a lot of the religious and moral values that are espoused by Christians, has breached over and over again, which he's admitted to and sometimes bragged about.
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, why isn't it possible that those people who happen to be Christian in there on Sundays find something politically in him that's very appealing? And
That's right. I really don't think it's about him as a person at all.
Yeah.
I think it's about the very long story of how a particular demographic was targeted by the Southern strategy and the way the Republican Party used it to convince people that they vote their values when they vote for whoever happens to be the Republican nominee. And yet someone like him exposes the kind of contradiction of that.
Well, and you point out in the book that the religion itself, the gospel itself, the scriptures of the Christian religion had been used, particularly in the American South, to actually defend the institution of slavery, which took quite a bit of theological jujitsu to make that work, right?
That's right. And this was a very well-funded thing mid-19th century when the abolition movement was pressing against the practice of slavery on moral grounds. There were plantation interests that invested in this argument. This argument emerges again after the Civil War, and it has a theme. Its theme is we have to take our country back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that theme has recurred over and over again. That's what I'm pointing to when I'm saying that slaveholder religion is at work in the present.
Well, tell us how it worked. And again, tell us how the religion of, as you say, a first century Palestinian Jew who preaches love, wholeness, and oneness could ever be used to defend an institution as ugly and as unchristian as slavery.
Yeah. Well, it started by trying to say that slavery was justifiable, right? Because after all, you know, Abraham and others in the Old Testament had practiced it. And St. Paul doesn't entirely condemn it. So folks began justifying slavery along those lines. It was an acceptable thing. But as the abolitionist movement grew, they had to fight back by saying that slavery was a good, and not just a good for those who, you know, were obviously benefiting from it, but a good for those who were enslaved. So this argument gets made that it was better for, you know, enslaved people to be here and hear the gospel than to die and go to hell in pagan Africa, as they imagined it. And this is this sort of radical separation between the well-being of people's bodies and their political fortune and the state of their souls that I think is still deeply a part of much of American evangelicalism and easy to exploit in these kind of political movements.
Well, tell us how that plays out and continues to play out, that same kind of theory in 2008, 2016, 2018.
Yeah. Well, it means that for many people, what they believe and what they do on Sunday mornings is not deeply connected to the relationships they have with those around them, right? So slaveholder religion kind of has two children in the 20th century. It has the kind of extremists who would, you know, back the KKK and be for white supremacy, whether it was Woodrow Wilson or Donald Trump. Right? We have, you know, that strand. But we also have a wide strand of people who say that, you know, we don't want to be too political. Church isn't political. We're going to kind of step back from that. And both of those contribute to the kind of political crisis that we face because the moral underpinnings of the prophetic tradition, the tradition of Jesus that could well influence our public life are kind of stifled by both of those.
Yeah, but one of the tracks that this takes is a kind of a thinking that builds in, and it builds in pretty easily because it's historically part of the church and at its root, the idea of one nation mm-hmm. selected by God to be the shining light on the hill, the chosen people. Mm-hmm. So while we're all brothers and sisters, yeah. God, in God's infinite wisdom, creates a chosen people who go out and make the world better.
Yeah.
For white supremacy, this can be an easy step to take.
That's
right. Us.
That's right. You take that and give it to the people who have the guns, and that's colonialism. That's right. Christendom. But Israel was not the powerhouse in the ancient world. And in the same way, what I'm trying to say in this book is that the counter to slaveholder religion that has always been here is those who are what I call reconstructing the gospel, right? Those who are on the margins, who've been pushed to the side, realizing that this is good news for them. That tradition grew up on the edges of plantations, you know, in the slave religion of those who trusted this Jesus and has been here ever since. And it's not, we sometimes call it the black church, but it's never been exclusively black, right? It's always open to everyone because this is a God who loves everybody.
Well, talk more about the reconstructed gospel, the yep. message in that gospel, and maybe what we've been missing all
yeah.
this time.
Frederick Douglass said, you know, in his first narrative of his life, we have to make a distinction between the Christianity of the slaveholder and the Christianity of Christ. Now, that's the other side. That's what drew him, and it's what drew Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and so many folks who were driven by their faith to confront evil in society and to advocate for an alternative, and in the meanwhile, to get as many people to freedom as they could, right? Now, that's 19th century, but that's today, right. too. We still need a movement that's advocating for change and getting as many people to freedom as we can. We got a sanctuary movement here in North Carolina offering sanctuary to folks. We got to have, you know, we got the Black Mamas bailout downtown today, mm-hmm. right here in Durham. We got to get as many people to freedom as we can, and we got to advocate for change in the public square that represents the basic moral values of our religious traditions.
Where does that appear in the text? How do you find comfort in that idea in the Gospels?
Well, Jesus gets up for his first sermon. He wants to quote the prophet Isaiah in his hometown, right? The Spirit of the Lord is on me to proclaim good news to the poor. You can't preach the gospel without preaching good news to the poor. That's where Jesus starts. And yet so often we want to reduce it to this, you know, me and Jesus personal relationship thing that we keep private and to ourselves. No. This does have public implications. Those public implications are about justice for the poor. Over 2,000 verses in Scripture that are about justice for the poor, the widow, and the stranger, the alien, the undocumented.
Is that can that be a movement? We're going to talk to Reverend Barber in just about a second here, who's also working with you and others to create a movement out of this. But let me ask you about the challenge, because I think it's easy to create religion as a political identity or at least a social identity. I'm a Christian. I go to church on Sunday. These are my friends. This is who I am and what I do. So it's more than just a belief in a sovereign God. It's a sense of who I am on earth, and people recognize that badge in me. You can organize around that, and you can organize politically. Is it as easy to organize around the concept of love as it is around, you know, protecting my gun rights?
Well, I'm not trying to say that it's easy, but right. I'm saying that it has been done and that there's no better representation of that tradition than Reverend Barber, so let's bring him on.
Let's do that. I'm talking to Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove about his book, Reconstructing the Gospel. The foreword was written by the Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is now the president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach and architect of Moral Monday movement here in North Carolina. He's also the pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church. Reverend Barber, welcome back.
Thank you, Brother Stacio, and I'm glad to hear Jonathan on. And I would want to also say I'm working as co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival that launches on this coming Mother's Day and begins on Monday with nonviolent moral fusion direct action across the country in 30 states, District of Columbia, with people of who are impacted by poverty, clergy, and other advocates to address systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, militarism, and the false moral narrative and distorted moral narrative of so-called Christian nationalism and religious nationalism.
Well, let me ask you, right on that point, who gets to decide which is the false narrative and which is the authentic narrative? How do you claim that right?
The scriptures.
Well, that's what they got. They got the scriptures. They point to the scriptures, and they will tell you God said Abraham had slaves, and Paul says slaves be faithful to your masters. There it is.
Yeah, well, the problem is they don't have the scriptures because you have 2,000 scriptures in the Bible that tell what the moral framework of people of faith ought to be. It says the poor, the least of these, the children, the women, the strangers. And if you get to Jesus, he clearly says in his first sermon, which is normative, the sermon that almost gets him killed. He says the poor, the brokenhearted, the bruised, the broken, and all of those made to feel unacceptable. And then in his last sermon, he said nations will be judged by how, not individual charity, but nations will be judged by how you treat the poor, the stranger, the sick, the imprisoned. The problem is there's a language we haven't brought up that the ancient church did, and that's heresy or theological malpractice. You cannot find text, particularly in the Gospels, or even in the Old Testament, where there is this justification for hurting the least of these, where there's a justification for greed, where there's a justification for to say, basically, if you're against homosexuals, if you're against abortion, if you're against prayer in the school, for a gun and for a tax cut, that's a Christian position. That's your position. And it's not even a conservative. One of the things the media has to stop doing is talking about conservative versus liberal. These terms were fed to us. To be a conservative Christian is to want to conserve love and justice and mercy. To be a liberal Christian is to want to spread love and justice and mercy as liberally as possible. And part of the problem is we've had folks who have tried to hijack the moral discussion. And, you know, Kevin Cruz in his book talks about how millions of dollars were spent to buy Christian pulpits in the 1930s and 40s by corporations who were upset with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal and Social Security. Millions of dollars were spent to find a way to say not that black people should be in slavery. That's not what we did in America. We said chattel slavery, that black people were not human. And therefore, if they're not human, then you don't have to afford to them the rights of other human beings. There were millions of dollars spent to undermine Dr. King and others and to create the so-called Southern strategy. So we, at best, what we see in this extreme, I'm an evangelical. And when the media even says 81% of white evangelicals, they're not even polling all of the evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about this, though, about the intervention in politics, because it does seem that there's a split and that there is a group of Christians and, you know, whether they're conservative or not, who have another view of Scripture and who use their very Scriptures to come up with a very different conclusion. So my question to you is, you know, these are heartfelt beliefs and they're rooted in God, which is supreme. So what's the argument that is persuasive and ultimately concludes that you're right?
Well, if you look down through the years, there were false prophets against Moses. There were false prophets against the prophets of Jeremiah and Isaiah. Jesus had his detractors all the time. Dr. King had people that told him he should stay out of politics. So did Frederick Douglass. Down through the years, there are people that say Pope Francis is wrong when he says poverty is a scandal. The difference is, though, you just said they have scripture, and I want to keep challenging that. most of the time you do not have people taking these positions saying that the scriptures say them. When so-called Christian nationalists are against health care, they don't base that on scripture. They base that on a political opinion, not the politics of Christ. When they say nothing about the attack on voting rights, when they say nothing about ecological devastation, when they do not challenge war and militarism, they don't base that on scripture. They just happen to say, I'm an evangelical Christian, and then give those opinions. The difference in our movement is we are actually basing it on scripture and scriptural traditions and the traditions of the church. You have always had this hijack. And what we find is when we go into places and we talk with them, like a few weeks ago when I was in Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, and sharing with people about our deep moral values and traditions, and sharing with them these powerful texts from the Bible, and talking about how, as a matter of faith, a matter of morality, is why I believe in single-payer health care and voting rights and living wages for the poor, and showing them the scriptures that actually say, pay the poor, pay people what they deserve. They say, oh my goodness, I've not been taught. You know, one of the things, Frank, we don't know, there was a slave Bible where the slave masters went in and put charcoal over all of the scriptures that dealt with deliverance and freedom. So what has happened is people have not received the gospel. That's what Jonathan is talking about, reconstruct. They've not received the gospel. Many times they have come to believe heresy. They've come to believe bits and pieces. And what we see is when it opens up, people's lives are fundamentally transformed. They're fundamentally transformed. But we have to challenge it. I've challenged Franklin Graham and some others. A few weeks ago, we had a revival in Lynchburg. Lynchburg, and we literally were served notice that if we even came on the campus of Liberty, we would be threatened with arrest for 12 months or $2,500. Why were they afraid of preachers coming on that campus, red letter Christians who want to point out what Jesus said in the red letters? Because they know that many of them, and I say this in deep love, and brother, they know that they have been feeding people what Paul called another gospel.
Let me ask you this though: has the moment passed? If you've got you're getting traction on this, you say if I could just open a few eyes among those who believe and have the faith, that things will change. But given what we're seeing now, trends in religion, trends of millennials to step away from every institution, including religion, has the moment passed to use that kind of appeal to get some kind of moral reckoning in this country?
Well, what we're seeing all across the country, I've traveled over 40 states, there's an urging, there's a hunger for a moral framework that's not as puny as left versus right, conservative versus liberal. I just left Grays Harbor, a homeless camp, where priests are there working in a community where there's 16,000 people and 1,000 of them are homeless. And many of those persons are white and millennials. You know, we've been to Alabama, where we've met people whose children have died in their arms because that state denied health care. And many of those folks came to be Christian. And one of the things we said was, wait a minute, if Jesus did anything, he set up free health clinics and gave everybody free health care. So how in the world can you be against this? What we're seeing is there's a deep hunger, and especially among young people, because we're talking about, we're building bridges with Jews and Christians and Muslims who are saying, wait a minute. You know, you just cannot continue to put your hand on Bibles and swear to uphold the Constitution and then violate not only the moral foundations of the Scriptures, but the moral foundation of the Constitution. You know, the Constitution says every policy that you pass as a politician, once you swear to uphold that Constitution, should be rooted in domestic tranquility, not domestic division and xenophobia. It says that you should be committed to the establishment of justice, not the establishment of unjust policies. You should be committed to promoting the general welfare, not undermining people's welfare. We have to have a recovery, a revolution of values, a moral revival in this country, because something has terribly has happened to the political now. And it's not just Republicans. Democrats and Republicans. Well, too often Democrats talk about, you know, the middle class, Republicans talk about the military, and nobody talks about the poor. There's a tremendous attention violence.
I want to thank you both, Reverend Barber. Thank you both very much for being on the program. Reverend William Barber, President and Senior Lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, and also author Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. His new book is Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion. Thank you both for being in the program.
Thanks for having us.
You can find links to their work and the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, artists with disabilities in North Carolina fight to tell their own narratives. You'll hear some of that on the State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned.